One last thing that I want to mention in the announcements before we get started. Next week, especially for here in the U.S. and Canada and possibly Europe, the first sermon is going to be up on the site because it's pre-recorded. And actually, the second one is too for Australia, New Zealand, and over here as well. But the first sermon, I'm going to ask everyone that you can download that, obviously, and be ready to play it for wherever you're meeting together, Canada, the U.S., or if there are a few, and we have a few situations where there are some that aren't able to travel, aren't going to be able to travel, so they're going to be keeping it where they live in their area. I'm going to ask that you not preview the sermon in advance. And I'm going to ask that if you do set it up for everyone else, that you only do the first 20 to 30 seconds of the sermon and to stop it. In other words, sometimes in order to get the screen set up, you have the picture come on, and it's a matter of people, if it's a screen, if it's a TV, you don't have to worry about it because your TV is already set. but I'm doing this because I want you to have the same impact from the first sermon and forward from that point on that everyone else is going to have. And I'm going to ask one other thing. No emails or phone calls to anyone after you hear the first sermon, because you may have the first opportunity to hear it. And I'm going to ask that there are no emails, because we have contacts worldwide in the church. And so I'm going to ask that wherever you live, if it's Australia, New Zealand, you're going to be the first ones to hear the sermon on the first day. I'm going to ask everyone over there to keep it to themselves, not to be emailing their friends that are in Europe at that time, or here in the U.S., and vice versa for Europe, that you have the jump and that you can then talk to different friends over here. I'm going to ask that none of that goes on, okay? I want this to be fair in the sense of having the same impact on everyone at the same time wherever they hear it. Make sense? Good. This is a very important feast, obviously. It's similar in most aspects for a feast as the one in 2005, so it's a very important one, and that's why I'm asking everyone to follow the guidelines so that it's fair to everyone in that respect to be able to hear and to be able to be moved by what they hear at the time they hear it, not from a friend. Hearing some of it, maybe not in full context. Okay, let's see. I think that's pretty much it. Today we're beginning a new sermon series. As the other series, as I mentioned last Sabbath, we're getting a little bit long, and I didn't want to go much farther, so we're going to have a little bit of a spin-off from the past series, which was entitled God's Glory and Greatness. And by now, that should be pretty much in our minds in the sense of knowing what that series was about, to be moved by how God works in our lives and to grasp the awesome ways He has planned and prepared things for so long through time for mankind, especially when it comes to His plan and purpose that's to be worked out in the first 6,000 years and beyond, obviously, but we live toward the end of the six. And so, again, to me it's a marvel. What other words can you use to describe, to explain the awesomeness of how God works, His great power of things that so often we don't think about in the same terms He's giving us the ability to see at this time? And I find that immensely inspiring when you see it in that context. And you'll see it now, especially as we go on with this sermon today in this new series. It's entitled The Rebuilding of Jerusalem. The Rebuilding of Jerusalem, Part 1. So, in the last series, in part 6, we ended as we were focusing on the end of the Babylonian kingdom, which was that head of gold that Daniel was able to tell Nebuchadnezzar what the statue signified, what it meant in the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. He didn't understand what he had seen, and no one could tell him. And Daniel told him, there is a God, the great God of heaven, that can reveal these things to man, and that He will be the one that will be giving this to you. And so he explained the different periods of time that would exist in history, the first being the kingdom of Babylon. He says, of which you are that head of gold. And that kingdom lasted almost right at 70 years. And then it ended, and a new kingdom came along, which is where we are now in the flow, in the story flow. So it began with Nebuchadnezzar primarily, his father, but primarily Nebuchadnezzar leading the armies and the things that took place. So we ended at that point in time. And again, the Babylonian kingdom then lasted to 539 BC, basically started in power in 609. And so it ended under 539 under the rule of Belshazzar when he made a feast for 1,000 of his lords. So we read that story last week. And what an incredible story. He brought out the vessels of gold from the treasury, that those things that had been taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar. And nearly 70 years later, it was 70 years later, actually took the first batch 3 years later, so that would have been 67 years before this point in time when they started taking some of the treasures out of the house of God. And they took those things, passed them around, and they were drinking wine out of the vessels that were in the temple of God. And it's at that point that he saw this hand on a wall that wrote, "Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin." And again, Daniel was brought forth to tell the king what this meant, because this was highly unsettling for him, as the scriptures bring out, and he wanted to know what this meant. So, again, last Sabbath story. And so he was told, your kingdom is numbered, and basically, it's over. This is it. And you're found wanting. You're found lacking. So, again, it's at this point here on that same night that the story begins of a new empire, a new kingdom. The next part of the statue, which was the chest, the breastplate, the breast area, and the two arms of silver. And this area here is the Medo-Persian Empire that's now going to rule. Now, what's fascinating is that God had planned this so long before that there would be these kingdoms in the time that he had introduced various things. Going way, way back, that he began to even reveal some of the truth of these things that would happen later on. And again, the glory and the greatness of Almighty God, of how meticulous, how perfectly planned life is for mankind in the first 6,000 years and the next 1,100. So again, in that same night, it's a story where Cyrus, who had been named by God right at 200 years previous to this, through Isaiah the prophet. So he had inspired Isaiah. And I find the chapter where this is revealed fascinating as well, because it's Isaiah 45. It's a powerful section of scripture that was used in 2005 when God began to reveal to us things that we had not grasped nor comprehended until he revealed it in 2005 concerning the fact that there was no Trinity, which we already knew. We understood that there was no such thing as a Holy Ghost. It's the Holy Spirit of God spoken of in Scripture. Man has used words like the word ghost to make it sound like it's a being or a person, and it's not. It's the power of God, the Holy Spirit. And so that was given to Herbert Armstrong to give to his church. And then later on, the last part of the Trinity then destroyed, in the sense that Joshua the Christ has not eternally existed. He had his beginning when he was born. So again, all these things revealed to us toward the end time here. Awesome. So nearly 200 years earlier, it was written about Cyrus, his name given, that God had shown what his name would be, and that would be given, that he would be given the ability to conquer Babylon in that respect. So, again, happened just the way he said in Isaiah 45. Then, let's turn over to 2 Chronicles. We'll start there. Some of these things are in Ezra. Some of these things are in 2 Chronicles, but we're going to finish here, or start, I'm sorry, in 2 Chronicles. The end of 2 Chronicles gives an account of the captivity and destruction of Jerusalem. Now, as we're going through this story today, to me, one of the greatest things that we can grasp and comprehend from this, to understand the importance of timing and how God works with people, and those, especially in that respect, that are going to be a part of His government and the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth, is to understand that much of what we're going to read through is about the end time and what took place at the end that is akin to the story on a physical. This is on a physical plane, but what happened later is on a spiritual plane. All of it planned by God. All of it written ahead of time, just like we read in Ezekiel. In Ezekiel 2 and 5 and then through there as we've gone through recently now and discussed some of those things that were about a very specific time. This is the same thing. And so things begin to be revealed about the captivity and the destruction of Jerusalem. That shouldn't escape us what this is about concerning God's church at the end. It then reveals specific events that would be fulfilled so that Jerusalem could be rebuilt after the captivity. And we covered the first part of this account in 2 Chronicles 36 and part 5 of the previous series. And we're going to pick it up again where we left off there. 2 Chronicles 36, verse 18. So all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Eternal, the treasures of the king and his princes, were all brought to Babylon. So this is a summation, it's what Chronicles is about, of events that took place. And it's showing here that over those different captivities of that time, this is what transpired. They even burnt the house of God. So by the time it was over, by the different captivities, at the end here, even the house of God, it says, was burnt, and they broke down the wall of Jerusalem and burnt all the palaces thereof with fire and destroyed its precious possessions. Verse 20, then those who had escaped from the sword, he carried away to Babylon. So we know of the different captivities. Got greater and greater till the last one. So it talks about all those who were carried away to Babylon, where they were servants to him, to Nebuchadnezzar, and his sons. In other words, those descendants that we have spoken of that went all the way down to Belshazzar, until the reign of the kingdom of Persia. So we're talking about a span there now of 70 years. Thus fulfilling the word of the Eternal by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land, now this is a bad translation here where it says had enjoyed. It's not saying that at all. It's a word that has to do with acceptance. Until the land could accept her Sabbaths. So again, it's symbolic here of various things that have taken place and making it clear here that what they had done, God brought judgment upon them to remove them over several times there of being conquered, until they were fully conquered. And so it says here, until the land could accept her Sabbaths, for as long as she lay desolate, she kept, it's not the word Sabbath here, it's the word rest. She kept rest to the fullness. Again, it's not to fulfill. It's amazing here how things are so screwed up sometimes in translations because they don't understand God's purpose, God's plan. And sometimes they distract away from what is true in the first place by design. She kept rest to the fullness of 70 years. Now, the scriptures talk about the 70 years as well, but this is one of the primary ones that really is one of the most succinct in that respect of what this is all about. Verse 22. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Eternal spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished. So there are several portions of 70 years in here that are really interesting that we're not going to spend the time going through. But again here, there's a point where sending them back begins. There's a point when they arrive. There's a point when it's built. And so many of these points have specific periods that to me are very clearly at 70 years. So it's not just one event that took place here that will fill that 70 years. So it says here again, "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Eternal spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah," that's referring to the 70 to get it accomplished, to fulfill it, "might be accomplished, the Eternal stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia." And to know how he did that is what's really inspiring, because he was given understanding of what it said in Isaiah. Those things were read to him when it talks about his name. His very name is mentioned there 200 years previous to that when it was written. And he's moved by that. God stirred him up to hear, to see that this is about him, and this is about something that God has given to him, and he takes it seriously. He's not being called, but he's being stirred up in his mind, in his being, in that spirit essence that God has placed in every human being. "Stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom." He was so moved that he followed through by doing this. "And also in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia." He was very moved by the fact that he was able to go in and conquer something that was unconquerable. That's how people felt. They felt Babylon could not be conquered by any army. That's why they were in partying when the Medes and the Persians were outside, because they weren't concerned that they were going to be overrun or conquered. They had such confidence, such cockiness about them, that nothing can happen to them. Well, God changed that. He let the Persians and the Medes in through the, talks about the gates would be crumbled in essence, and they'd be able to have the ability to enter right into the city. And it was that night, it says, that Belshazzar died, was put to death. So he's been moved by all these things, and now he sees his name and the fact that it was God Almighty who gave this to him, and he believes it. He sees it. It's kind of like when you're called. There are certain things you see. Nobody can give that to you. But when the ability to see something is there because it's true, and this is what God did, it was true in his mind, in his being. He was very deeply moved by this. That's why he took this action. "Thus says the king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth has the eternal God of heaven given me." Wow. Because that's what it said. "And has charged me." He's the part of silver now. He doesn't know that necessarily, that part of it obviously, but he believes what it was said about the eternal God, that all the kingdoms would be given to him to rule, all the power that he had there, vast power, "given me and has charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Of any who is among you of his people, the Eternal, his God, be with him, and let him go up." So that's what he was telling them in this decree. So anyone who wants to return, any of you who desire to, go up to Jerusalem. Now we're going to go on now to Ezra, because the story is recapped there somewhat, and that's where it goes in the story flow now. But again here, Ezra now is one of the leaders who returned after the captivity. So he doesn't return right here, but he returns eventually. So Ezra begins writing. That's why I find it so incredible. All the different ones who were taken into captivity, the various ones who grew up in captivity, and the various ones that God raised up during that period of time who were prophets who had sections of the Bible and Old Testament that are written there that God gave to them. So again here, he was one of the leaders who returned from the captivity to help lead in the reestablishment of Jerusalem. He was a scribe and a priest, a descendant of Aaron, the high priest. Now they didn't lose sight of these while they were in captivity. And the Jewish people have been very much like that through history anyway. But in this respect, at this time here, they knew who they were. They knew who they descended from. They'd never lost these things. They continued to keep the Sabbath, even in captivity. The history is even they built places in essence, not, it wasn't, because Jerusalem wasn't there anymore, obviously, this is where a lot of the construction of various kinds of temples that they called, and they began to worship there. So they continued that in Babylon even. So again here, he was a descendant of Aaron, the high priest, and in this account, Ezra is writing about some of the history of where this process began, of where the captives began to return, and how this happened. And he brings it up in the story flow to when he finally went, because he goes later on. He doesn't go right away. Most people reading the book of Ezra think that he went, that this is happening right then and there. And some historians do, and they get all screwed up because they can't put the timing together, then things don't fit. Well, there's a reason, because he's just going back recapping history for a time until he actually went up to Jerusalem. Ezra 1, verse 1. Now, this is taking off from Chronicles. That's all it's doing. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Eternal by the mouth of Jeremiah might be or become fulfilled, the Eternal stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, the king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and put also in writing, saying, so he's repeating here the things that are written in the last part of Chronicles, and he's going to continue on now with the story. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Eternal God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him an house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Of any who is among you of his people, his God be with you, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of God of Israel, the house of the Eternal God of Israel. He is the God. So it begins to add things here that weren't in Chronicles. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. So it's revealing even more as we go through the story here. So whoever remains in any place where one will go on the journey. So what's he saying? He's saying, of all you who go up, choose to go up, any who remain here in Babylon, this is what you're to do. Okay? So he's being very specific here in what he's telling them. So whoever remains in any place where one will go on the journey, let them in of his place, help him with silver and with gold and with goods and with beasts, along with the freewill offering of the house of God that is in Jerusalem. Pretty strong. Then there arose of the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites. They all knew who they were. The different ones who were priests of the Levites, they knew who they were. They never lost track of that. Some were born in captivity by this time, obviously, and they knew who they were. And the priests and the Levites, with all whose spirit God had awakened. So God stirred up, first of all, Cyrus, and it uses this term here, all whom God awakened to do this. There are people he moved in the thousands to return. It was in their heart, in their mind, in their being, in their spirit to do this. That's what it's saying. With all whose spirit God had awakened to go to build the house of the Eternal, which is in Jerusalem. Now see, when I read this, I see the present time. Because this is a physical thing, spiritual by the means of what God did here in moving people to do this. But that is literally what had to happen to everyone who fell asleep, who were moved to continue to go forward and rebuild something. It's exactly what happened in God's church after the apostasy. Now, if that doesn't send a few shivers up and down your spine, it does mine. Then all those round about them strengthened their hands with vessels of silver, with gold, with goods, and with beasts, and with precious things, along with all that was willingly offered. Also Cyrus the king brought forth the vessels of the house of the Eternal, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken forth out of Jerusalem, and had put them in the house of his gods. Even this did Cyrus, king of Persia, bring forth by the hand of Meredath the treasurer, and numbered, or counted it, in other words, it's recorded, and so it's all numbered, counted them unto Sheshbazzar, the prince. It's a ruler, it's a governor, it's a word used for that. of Judah. So this is in 538, 1 year later, after he had conquered. And so these things now were being done, and they're going forward with plans. So it takes a little while before all this is happening, before they can actually get everything together and then begin to get the people moved together and start the journey down to Jerusalem. This doesn't happen overnight. Which brings us to another 70 in a little bit. So although this account, again, in the first chapter of Ezra is about the beginning process of captives being given support and freedom by Cyrus, king of Persia, to return to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Again, Ezra was not among this first group. He's telling the story in past tense and bringing it up to the present when he begins to reveal when he went. Because a little bit later, he's going to be sent to Jerusalem. So there are different waves that return, just as there were different waves that were taken captive out of Babylon. Awesome. So he's simply giving an account of how the process began and what leads up to a second return of people to Jerusalem, which involves him. Now, I want to point out another thing here about Sheshbazzar. There are certain things written in history or even in Scripture that they really don't know necessarily who Sheshbazzar is, but it appears very much like, and I believe with all my being, is Zerubbabel, the same person. One has a Babylonish name, one has one of Judah. Just like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and all of them, they were given different names by some of the others. And so here was one name that was given, and this is who he counted and numbered out all the wealth to, in the sense of what was in the temple. And now it's been numbered to a specific individual, but it's very clear who actually takes these and is responsible over them, and it's Zerubbabel. Which, anyway, when you read those accounts and you know history of some of these things, it just makes those things come alive even that much more when you read some of these stories. So many from Judah returned and began reconstruction of the altar and then work on the foundation of the temple. Again, these things took time, but they started with the reconstruction, if you will, of the altar itself. So we're going to look at various parts of the story here. And we begin reading in Ezra again here about the return. And from there, toward the end of chapter 1, the items from the temple are listed. So we're not going to go through all that because there's no point in it. But we're going to go on past that to chapter 2 now. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now these are the children of the province that went up out of the captivity of those who had been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away unto Babylon, and came again unto Jerusalem and Judah, every one unto his city. So they came into that region, and specifically even talks about some of the different towns or cities around there, who came with Zerubbabel. Then it goes on to say, Joshua, Nehemiah, Seraiah, Rela, and so forth. And then jumping all the way down to verse 64. The whole assembly numbered 42,360. This is a big thing. It's taking place. 42,360 people. Also their servants and their maids, of whom were 7,337. So very explicit here what's recorded in the numbers. Chapter 3. Verse 1. Then when the seventh month had come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered themselves together as one in Jerusalem. Then stood up Joshua, the son of Jozadak, with the brethren, the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, his and his brethren, and built the altar of God. So this is how they started. They had to have an altar to begin this. Built the altar of the God of Israel in order to do what they wanted to do first. To offer burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So they set the altar upon its bases for fear upon them because of the people of those countries. Now, you have to understand here, 70 years has passed and they've been taken into captivity. And so just as they grew and prospered in Babylon, which they did, others grew in their own rights by taking that land that was left vacant, and they moved into it and prospered in their own physical way. And so you have another people coming back in mass numbers, and this isn't taken very well. There were a lot of problems. There were some battles at times, and they had to be prepared for war on a constant basis. That's what I'd call it, is war. But there would be those who would come up against them at different times. So they had a lot of battles going through this process of striving to rebuild the temple. And so that's part of the story here then. So they set up the altar first, as it says here, and offered up the offerings, the burnt offerings unto the Eternal and burnt offerings. And they offered burnt offerings there on unto the Eternal, even burnt offerings morning and evening, as they were supposed to. They kept also the Feast of Tabernacles, as it is written. Awesome. Timely. We're right there, Feast of Tabernacles. As it is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings by number, according to the custom, as the duty of every day's requirement, or every day required. So anyway, it's a part of a process here, very physical, very ordered way the Levitical system was set up, and how to offer up offerings and the like, and especially for the feast time like it's mentioning here. Verse 8 of chapter 3. Now in the second year of their coming unto the house of God, so again here, this is talking about the journey down, and now this is talking about a period of 2 years that had passed on. Now in the second year of their coming unto the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month began Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and the remnant of their brethren, the priests and the Levites, and all they who had come out of the captivity unto Jerusalem. I hope you're seeing what this is about on a spiritual plane concerning the end time, because it's an exact, how would you put it? Diagram, plan. It's like a blueprint. Here's a period of time that God's going to work something out. Babylon's going to be there, going to take Judah captive. Persia's going to arise. They're going to come back and begin to rebuild. And descriptions that are used. But it's a blueprint that's happening on a physical plane of something that's to happen later on toward the end on a spiritual plane in God's own church. Because the point being, we can look at something happening on a physical scale like this and be in awe of what happened to them over all this period of time, and indeed we should, and how God worked various things out. But which one do you think is more important in the sense of what God was doing? Something physical and a physical construction of something, or something spiritual that's far more meaningful, that's a part of something of completing a temple and the rebuilding of the temple that had to take place after the apostasy? I hope you understand the answer, because that in itself should be very moving to everyone who has part and an opportunity to be a part of something so incredible. Because that's what this is about. We can be in awe of something very physical that took place, but we're to learn lessons as well of something that happened a long time ago, because that's what we're supposed to do. How many times have we gone through and had various sermons, especially in the beginning of PKG, talking about rebuilding of the temple, talking about the rebuilding of the walls around Jerusalem, because that was on a spiritual plane. This was on a physical one, but we're to learn from it and be inspired by it and to understand one is more important than the other. Because God is not concerned with physical sacrifice. God was not concerned in that respect of things that could be offered up on the altar because it didn't take away sin. It wasn't about a spiritual calling. It was about the fulfillment of something on a physical plane so that a certain people could continue on, so that certain examples could be there for us to learn from and for people to learn from in time, because most of them aren't going to learn until the Great White Throne. And then for the church later on. So it talks about this process here. Began Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and the remnant of their brethren, the priests and the Levites. They were large in number. In the end, it wasn't large in number, but it was about a remnant. It's what Ezekiel talks about a remnant. And the Levites, and all they who had come out of the captivity unto Jerusalem. What do you think happened in the apostasy? It was much faster. We don't have this length of time, 70 years to work within, but we do have time frames to work within that God is going to reveal more about later on. But we've already know several of them that we have fulfilled in the sense of the church and things that took place in them that was unique and different in each one. Then about a captivity. That's what the thrust was about taking the church, God's people, into captivity again. And if God hadn't awakened, stirred up by the power of His Spirit, there wouldn't be a church today. But God has a plan to keep the church going. Nothing can stop it. God was going to see to it from the time of Christ on that the church would continue to exist no matter what happened. And so they appointed Levites from 20 years old and upward and set forward the work of the house of the Eternal. So it's taken work. And individuals who became a part of it have had to work. One of a spiritual thing. And where is that work? In the temple. On self. Because everyone called out of that period of time, everyone who has been added to it since that time, has to work. They have to work on themselves and what's being built as part of a structure. To me, it's beautiful to understand that. It truly is. To build something of rock, wood, and so forth is one thing, but to be a part of building and working on something that is up here in the mind, the transforming of the mind and the thinking that takes place, it's hard to find words to describe it all, how beautiful it is. Verse 10. Then when the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Eternal, I'm sorry, I'm not sorry, but I'm just dumbfounded. We did this. What did we have to do? As soon as the apostasy was over, we had to start building things. The foundation. Passover was the biggest of all because it was being destroyed in the scattered groups. And so God gave us a job to do. And it was one of rebuilding, and not only of rebuilding, but making it stronger than it ever was. Giving us understanding of Ben-Har Abayim, things of that nature, and what that means. Between the two evenings, that's only mentioned twice in Scripture, one in Leviticus 23. Making it very clear that Passover is Ben-Har Abayim, between the two evenings. And how dumb were we to not see that and understand that, but we didn't until God gave it. And that's a humbling thing to understand then. When it's used again later on in explaining about atonement, it's between the two evenings. Well, duh, so is every Sabbath and every other holy day. It's exactly between the two evenings. And yet we, before that, during worldwide, during Philadelphia, and during Laodicea, there was this concept that as soon as the sun went down, there's this period of time that there's still light in the sky until it gets dark. And that's when you're to observe it. In that little cranny. Whatever that means, before the darkest of dark. When you hear some of the... What are they called? Jewish The what?
Scholar?
No, there's not a word for them, but that's close. Jewish scholars, they call themselves scholars. But the high priests, whoever they are, some of them through time, what they've written, what they've said about it. Anyway, it's amazing, some of the rabbis, what they've come up with, but the high priests especially, the ones who call themselves the cream de la cream of the group. They're the ones who made some of these stupid comments about when, because this is where they began to get all screwed up, and so did the church then, because they followed what, surely the Jews know what they're doing, at the going down of the sun. Well, let's see, at 12 o'clock, you know what happens? It starts going down, so that's what they started to follow, because they didn't understand that on the 13th, at the going down of the, it wasn't talking about that, but they couldn't understand this thing about the sacrifices. And that's why they didn't understand the Passover. That it's not a sacrifice from people. It's a sacrifice of God, of Christ, given to us. But there were sacrifices on that day that began to be killed, in the sense they weren't sacrificed to God until sundown after Passover. So I'm sorry, I got mixed up there on the 13th and the 14th. I get screwed up on the last part of the 14th. I'm getting screwed up on the 14th. And so that period of time there, especially. So the start of it for them, yes, from sundown to going down to the sun, they take that in Deuteronomy in the wrong way, and they get confused on that. And then later on the sacrifices in the afternoon, they get screwed up again because they don't understand. They begin to kill animals by the thousands. So they would all be prepared and ready for the offerings at sundown when the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread begins. So things that we learn through time that have been so messed up, and yet this is where God had to start, Passover, so that we could be more deeply moved by understanding what it means, Ben Harbaim, and some of those, because people were trying to move it into the 15th. Some people were trying to start early. And yet it says right there in Leviticus, it's in that day, in the 14th day. It's not in the 13th, it's not in the 15th, it's in the 14th, if we just take it for what it says. But anyway. So this is what we had to do. We had to do that with Pentecost. We had to reestablish the foundation of Pentecost because it was being lost in God's church. It was scattered. Already by that time it had been tarnished. And so one thing after another, that people don't go off to heaven. Doctrine after doctrine began to work their way into in the latter part of Laodicea, and people's minds began to be screwed up and began to fall asleep on a spiritual plane, till we all were asleep on a spiritual plane by the time of the apostasy. And God had to stir up His Spirit in those whom He decided He was going to stir up their spirit to continue to fulfill something, a remnant of His church. So anyway, verse 10 again. When the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Eternal, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites and the son of Asaph with cymbals, to praise the Eternal with the ordinance of David, king of Israel. So they were following those things that were written out according to what they should do in their service. So the struggles of rebuilding the temple were many. Then and now. And we're to understand that. We didn't understand it as we were going through some of those battles, but there's been battle after battle after battle after battle. It was not meant to be easy on a spiritual plane. And hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who had the opportunity to be stirred up in spirit have gone by the wayside. So the struggles of rebuilding the temple were many, as well as later when the walls, because they began to be attacked even more so then. I like it when in one part there it talks about how they're rebuilding on the wall and they have their armaments right beside them as they're working. They're ready to battle if need be, if they're called to, if something happens while they're working on rebuilding the temple. I mean the walls around the temple. And that's great as a story, inspiring and moving. To understand this is symbolic of the thing we have to do while you're fighting the fight. You have to be with your armor. If you're without it, if you're not on guard, if you're not alert, you can become one of the victims, one who has conquered, one who goes off into captivity again, to lose all that. And many have, because they didn't keep the armor. They didn't stay in guard. They didn't keep watchful. I tell you, when I give this sermon here, I'm sorry, I could give hours and hours and hours about this, about these battles and things that have happened on a spiritual plane, because they are so many. I do in sermons from time to time, but I don't even touch on many of them. Haven't. There are so many of things that have happened and taken place to destroy, to stop the process, to end it, just like there. So, again here, even as they built on the wall later on, all of which covers quite a bit of time in this particular story here, they had a lot of opposition at different times with those who had been, again, living in the region of Judah. So a lot of these events and the timing of them is muddled up because, like I said here about Ezra and how people read it. But let's continue on in chapter 4 here. At this point here where we're going to start, we're going to skip a section that is basically about some of the fighting that had taken place in the region beforehand and some false accusations had gone out about the rebuilding of the temple and the Jews that were there. And there was a king that did listen to the false accusations and stopped the building of the temple for 10 to 14 years before they started it up again. So basically he commanded them to stop. So these people in that region had sway because they were a part of this kingdom of Persia. They had been conquered, so they gave their allegiance in to the new kings, the Medes and the Persians. And this is a part of the story flow then, that this one king, in essence, listened and told them to stop, but never gave them the authority to start again. And so the story gets a little funny as we go along here. But anyway, because God told them to start again. They didn't get it from the king. We'll get to that. So this is part of that story. Ezra 4, verse 24. It says, then ceased the work of the house of God. So it's telling us what happened. I'm not going to go through the entire story that leads up to this and the king they went to and what he said, but he stopped. And so this is what it's saying here. Then ceased the work of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So again, this was 10 to 14 years later. Don't know for sure what it was there, but somewhere in that vicinity. Then the following verse, chapter 5, verse 1, says, then the prophets, Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah. So here we go, two more prophets. Incredible, all the prophets that came out of this period of time. Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, rose up, as did Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and began to build the house of God, in essence, once again, because they had stopped. Now, they're told by the prophet, this is what God is telling you, start building again. So who do they listen to? The government or God? God. And began to build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. And with them were the prophets of God helping them. So, how? By what they were saying, by what they were preaching, by what they were teaching from that was coming from God. Haggai 1, verse 1. You don't always turn there, so if you have a computer, that's fast. An iPad, that's fast. May not be as fast if you're looking through the Old Testament. Some of the placement of some of these, we don't always go there, but toward the back of the minor prophets. Haggai 1, verse 1. In the second year of King Darius, in the sixth month. So here now we're talking about, again, the same period of time. On the first day of the month, the word of the Eternal came to Haggai the prophet to Zerubbabel. So, again, we're picking up a part of what it's saying here, of what was already covered in Ezra. The son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, saying, thus says the Eternal of hosts, saying, this people says. What people? the people around there, the Jews who had come into the area as a whole. This people says, the time has not come, the time that the Eternal's house should be built. So they were told to stop, so they stopped for 10 to 14 years, and what happened in that length of time? It wasn't good. It wasn't good. Time is not a friend when it comes to learning about God and applying, living what is given. You have to be careful. You have to be on guard. We understand that for the church. We have to be on guard constantly. Because if we're not careful, what happens? And this is what happened to them. Physical things began to be more important. They had lived there now for 14 to 16 years, reestablished homes, reestablished ways of living and so forth to survive in that area once again. And that became their focus because they weren't focusing on rebuilding of the temple or the walls anymore over a long period of time. Now, spiritually, that's hideously dangerous. You can't go that long. But any length of time for God's people to move away from their focus, away from building the temple and the walls to guard what has been given to us, can be exceedingly dangerous, and it has been to so many who have gone by the wayside. So lesson after lesson after lesson, things that happen there physically happen at the end on a spiritual plane, very powerfully so. So people were saying, and this is the lesson in this here, be on guard, be careful. Don't let this physical world begin to be your primary focus, as though this isn't the time. This is the time. It's just not in our time, maybe. Maybe we like to see things happen more quickly. We like to see things come together when we thought they were supposed to at that point in time, and they didn't. And then we learn whose fault was that. It's like the apostasy. Whose fault was the apostasy? Every one of us who were in worldwide. It's what God says. We all became lukewarm, and He can't accept that. So He spewed it out of His mouth. It's like it uses the word vomit. And vomit is not a pretty sight. So to be a part of vomit, it's like, that stinks, doesn't it? Sure does. Did I stink? Yes, I did. Because that's what it's like if you begin to fall asleep. You're not doing what you should be doing spiritually. You should be more on guard and fighting certain battles that are there in front of you. Regardless of where the chips may fall. It's what you learn from that. So, same thing here. And so I think about the apostasy as well, not just the apostasy, but then we can go on. 2012, we found out whose fault was that? God's fault? No, it was certain people's fault because they gave up their crown. And then it's been offered to others. Now, I find that inspiring in many ways because for those who gave up their crown, there was a flaw somewhere there going quite a ways back anyway, and God already knew that. And knew it before it ever came even close to that. It's part of His plan. And we learn from all that. And others in time will learn from all that. So it's all in God's time. And we continue to press forward. That's what this is about. It's about staying in the fight. So, again, stories like this are incredibly inspiring because it gives something like this. And it says, the people say, the time has not come. The time of the Eternal's house, the Eternal's house should be built. Not a smart move. See, we can do things and not realize spiritually this is what we're saying. This has already happened to people. This is not the time. I think, how much more saber rattling do you have to hear? How intense, just over the past year, have things gotten? You have to be pretty blind, deaf, not to hear, not to be able to see things that are happening in this world. Putin talking in the way he is. What kind of a mind would threaten the use of nuclear weapons? What kind of a mind is capable of that? I think of the example which is apropos in many ways of the bear. And you keep poking at a bear. I think of some that I've seen on TV at times when they show certain videos on there and they show these people trying to get up close to a bear to take his picture. I think, where is your mind? And then the bear turns out not to be friendly. Shock. You know? Duh. And people going on safaris and doing some of the stupidest things. Sometimes you think, these are wild animals that can kill you quickly. Anyway, sometimes we're not bright. And that's the way it is in the world today. We're not too bright. And maybe you've heard in the news, because I believe it with all my being, some are pushing more than they should be pushing at him. And it's all for a reason. If you want a change in regime and you think you can do it, what a stupid thing to do, to push someone who has nuclear weapons and is losing what looks like losing to the world, a war, to where generals disappear or are replaced, where things like this are happening on a constant basis. And how much can a mind like that take before they'll be pushed into a corner? I was listening this morning to some give their opinions. I just love it. It's not news. It's, well, what do you think? Well, I think, it's like, I don't really care what you think because you're stark raving mad. And it's like, oh, he's not going to do that. I think he's just bluffing. How do you do something like that in a world with nuclear weapons and you're banking on the fact that they're bluffing? And if they're not, then our military knows how to deal with that. How do you deal with nuclear weapons that once they're fired, there's not much you can do? You can fire some back if you have time. If they're not coming out of submarines that are so close to your shore, you don't have time to stop them anyway. And if they're hypersonic, you're really up the creek because we have nothing to take down a hypersonic missile. So we're pretty much fish in a bowl. What a horrible thing. And yet that's where we are in history and time. So if we can't see that's pretty bad. Because of all people, we should be able to see where we are in this world. We know it's going to happen. We know we live in that time, prophesied for so long ago. Know that Russia is going to be one of those nations. China is going to be one of those nations. And that Europe, primarily Germany, is going to be one of those nations again that does things that are unthinkable. But they feel pushed into a corner too. You know, when you start pushing people into a corner, what are you going to do? What are you going to do when all the oil's cut off and your people are going to turn against you? What's happened in times past in history when your people turn against you? Well, you've got to do something. So who is the threat? This time it'll be the U.S. is considered the threat. So we know those things are going to come to pass. And we're almost there. That's why for so many years, you know, how long have I talked about it? It's our last car. It's our last car. And I really think this is. And that's all we can do is laugh about it sometimes because you keep going forward because we don't know the exact timing of things that God has in mind or is going to reveal to us as we go along. But we're going to learn from it as we go along. And so it is about maybe going somewhere. Are we going to come back? I don't know. I'm planning for a meeting in November down in Dallas. May not be here for it. I don't know. Things could happen. Things could happen during the feast. Do you understand that? See, I believe that with all my being. And I'm prepared up here. And that's where we have to be. Because things could happen that quickly in the world. Because there are some other prophecies that have to do with a portion of Europe. Certain tribes, two in particular, that help protect some of God's people at the end time. Anyway, interesting. Someone gets stuck in a certain area and God will take care of it. Wherever we are, whoever we are, we'll be taken care of. We're going to be where we're supposed to be at any time. But you better be prepared in your thinking. So the time has not come, the time of the Eternal's house should be built. I've seen that played out in people's lives over and over again, and they're gone. Then the word of the Eternal came to Haggai the prophet, saying, It is time for your cell, is it time for your cells to dwell in your padded houses? Is this your concern about your future, about your welfare, about your continuation in life? Is this your focus in life of what you have built, and now you have your padded houses and you can take it easy? And this house, the temple, be in ruins? Is this the time, or should you keep focusing on the building of the temple? And that's the message. That's what we want. Especially if you've been called to be a part of 144,000, which we don't know who is. But you'd all better be fighting for it like you are. At least that's my hope. I don't want this to go on any longer than need be. So, but God knows the timing and the working of, with different people and how long certain things take. So I know it's going to work in, according to His will. But anyway, we have to yield ourselves to that process too. Now therefore, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, consider your ways. Take a good hard look at yourself. That's been going out for 2 years now. Strong. Basically telling them, as it says here in Hebrew, set your heart on your ways, whatever your ways should be. What are your ways? Is it God's way? Is God first? Better be right. Verse 12, jumping down. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Eternal, their God, and the words of Haggai the prophet, and the Eternal, or as the Eternal, their God, had sent him, and the people feared the presence of the Eternal. Those are things we have to look at in our own lives. Fear that has to do with turning away from what God has said, not listening to what God has said. And that's a healthy kind of fear in life in that respect. Then Haggai, the Eternal's messenger, spoke the Eternal's message to the people, saying, I am with you. It's a powerful message. It's what God's telling us. I am with you, says the Eternal. So the Eternal stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people. And they came and worked on the house of the Eternal of Hosts, their God. What a beautiful story. What a beautiful way of expressing it. Now, at this stage, we come to an interesting story. Those who had returned had already experienced a lot of opposition from those who lived in the region while they were rebuilding the temple. And they had already been shut down once and had begun to drift in behavior and focus in their thinking. And then we come to this section here in Ezra chapter 5. This is an account where others now who came forward, who were leaders of the region in the government under Persia, who had been possibly apart with Babylon, but now had changed that allegiance, which normally happened. And so often then those kinds of leaders were picked up and used if they were pledged that kind of allegiance in to the king of a conquering nation. So they did to Persia, the Medes and the Persians. And so some of those came up, but their motives weren't so good as others had before, because they were in that region and they really weren't keen on the Jews coming back and reestablishing themselves there, because they had been there for so long, to them that was theirs. So here they come up and they handle it a little bit differently this time, and that's what this story is about. But they basically wanted to bring a halt again to the building. They didn't want to see this finished because they saw it as a strength to these people, the Jews. Ezra 5, verse 1. Then the prophet Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophets, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem, even to them in the name of the God of Israel. So Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, rose up and began to build the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And the prophets of God were with them, helping them. At the same time, Tatnai, the governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar Boznai and their companions came to them and asked them, who has commanded you to build the temple and finish this wall? So here they are, leaders on the other side of the river, possibly speaking of the other side of the Euphrates coming down through this region here, because they oftentimes use that word to refer to a division then of rest of the Babylon and the area of the Medes, or Medes and the Persians, I should say, who conquered that region. Then verse 4, it goes on to say, then accordingly, we told them. So here they're going through this particular story, and it's telling here what they're going to do now. Then accordingly, we told them the names of the men who were constructing this building. But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews. So this is a story then of this governor and what he does with information he's gathering and why he's asking them these questions. And he's going to report them to the king, to Darius. Then accordingly, we told them the names of the men who were constructing this building, but the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews. So they could not make them cease until a report could go to Darius. Then a written answer was returned concerning this. So basically they're saying, we went there, we found out information, and now they send this report then to Darius. And then Darius answers back. But anyway, this is a part of the story. And so it says here, this is kind of an awkward way of stating it all, but it says, this is a copy of the letter then of Tatnai that he sent. And this is what he said. The governor of the region beyond the river, that's who he is, showing he has the responsibility of governing over this region under him, under Darius, and Shethar Boznai and his companions, the Persians who were in the region beyond the river, to Darius the king, they sent a letter to him in which it was written, to Darius the king, all peace. Let it be known to the king that we went into the province of Judea to the temple of the great God, which is being built with heavy stones, timber, and being laid in the walls. And their work goes on diligently and prospers in their hands. Then we asked those elders, who commanded you to build this temple and to finish these walls? Because they had known of the authority that had come down to stop them, and they wanted to know who has told you you could start again, because they didn't want to see it start again. We also asked them the names to inform you, that we might write the names of the men who were chief among them. Thus they returned us an answer, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we are rebuilding the temple that was built many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and completed. But because our fathers provoked the God of heaven to wrath, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed this temple and carried the people away to Babylon. However, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, King Cyrus issued a decree to build this house of God. Also the gold and the silver and the articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple that was in Jerusalem and carried into the temple of Babylon, these King Cyrus took from the temple of Babylon, and they were given to the hand of Sheshbazzar, whom he made governor. Then he said to him, take these articles, go, carry them to the temple that is in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be rebuilt on its former site. Then the same Sheshbazzar, Zerubbabel, came and laid the foundation of the house of God. He laid the foundation. He was responsible. It's very clear, really, which is in Jerusalem. But from that time even to now. So here they are. They're writing the story to the king. They have a certain motive, but they're doing it in a pretty shrewd way in how they're addressing it, because they knew that it had been told to stop. But Perhaps it's in this first part of the story that they didn't know about, so they're walking a little more carefully. If Cyrus had said this and it's recorded accordingly, they probably ought to be a little more careful, because this is what they were told. So if they only had part of the history and not the whole story, so not totally stupid, as some others were before this. So again here, they came and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. But from that time, even until now, it has been under construction, and it is not finished. Now therefore, if it seems good to the king, let a search be made in the king's treasure house, which is there in Babylon, whether it is so that a decree was issued by King Cyrus to build the house of God at Jerusalem, and let the king send us his pleasure concerning this. So, giving the appearance of being totally subservient, in unity with whatever the king says, smooth talk, wise talk, political, and how people are, because they want to keep their office, and they sure don't want their heads cut off. So they're very careful about what they wrote here. It's really quite shrewd. Just didn't totally work the way they wanted to. Chapter 6, verse 1. Then King Darius issued a decree, and a search was made in the archives where the treasures were stored in Babylon. Then at Ecmetha, in the palace that's in the province of Media, a scroll was found, and in it a record where the following was written. So they found this, and here is how they recorded it as far as the government under Cyrus at that time. In the first year of King Cyrus, issued a decree on the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the house be rebuilt, the place where they offered sacrifices, and let the foundations of it be firmly laid. Its height 60 cubits, and its width 60 cubits. So this is approximately 100 feet by 100 feet, or 30 meters by 30 meters. Four with three rows of heavy stones, and one row of new timber. So very explicit. Isn't that amazing that this was written? How did Cyrus know all these things? How was to be done? Let the expense be paid from the king's treasury. Also let the gold and the silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple, which is in Jerusalem, and brought to Babylon, be restored and taken back to the temple, which is in Jerusalem, to its place, and deposit them in the house of God. So when I see something like this, read something like this, it's hard not to read it in a context of something that's unique in that respect, because for us, the treasure is not silver and gold. It's not about a physical temple. It's about the things that we're blessed to have in the mind that are our treasure. That's where it is. It's in the truth that God gives to us. It's in the understanding of the things that God has given to us over time. And so again, I'm very moved by the things we see physically that were done then, and the things that are spiritual that happened to God's people, that have happened in the matter of rebuilding of the temple. I'm going to stop there. I'm getting quite warm. I wish I wasn't wearing this, but my mind doesn't work as well when it's at this point. So we're going to, and this is probably enough to digest for today. So we'll continue with part two. We're going to have different schedules now. It's going to get kind of complicated. The guys know when to show these, so you'll have part two and some others as well in between. Have a great feast.